Well, before I start, there's a brief advertisement for the network. That's the network on quantum geometry and quantum gravity. And we will, over the next 5 years, be giving away about €500,000. Unlike the European Commission networks, this is a different one, European Science Foundation. This is open to anybody in Europe to participate. You don't have to be a member or anything to start with. And there's money for meetings. There's a call for workshop proposals. Anybody can propose a workshop. And of course, when they're organised, people can then attend them. And there's also travel grants, which are available. And these are for anybody who lives in European country A to visit somebody in European country B. So now to come to the topic of my talk. So the organisers asked me to give a brief summary of the status of quantum gravity. So this could be exceedingly brief, actually. So work in four-dimensional space-time, quantum gravity, is essentially incomplete. There are a number of approaches or would-be theories, and they're either mathematically complete but physically unrealistic, or mathematically incomplete in some way. And therefore, any sort of physics from them is just part calculation and part wishful thinking.
You seem to imply that the second class is physically realistic.
Well, it may be one day. So, for example, in loop quantum gravity, there's quite a lot of work, but essentially nobody knows what the Hamiltonian constraint is in this theory. So this means that when you write down a state, you don't know if it's a physical state or not. So people have proposed various ways of describing, for example, a black hole, but again, we don't know if this state would satisfy the Hamiltonian constraint if we had it, and therefore we don't know if any of the calculations are physically realistic. So in string theory, again, that's theoretically incomplete. We don't know certain what string theory is, and we certainly don't seem to have four-dimensional quantum gravity from it. There are various spin foam models, which I'm going to talk about in 3D today, but in 4D, the various models, and you can make them more or less mathematically complete, but as far as we know, any of the models proposed don't look like quantum gravity. But, you know, work is continuing in those directions. There are various other approaches. For example, you can do approaches like statistical mechanics, have random triangulations or random something or other. The problem with these approaches is that, as far as we know, these theories don't have any mathematical properties. So although one could simulate on a computer what happens, you can't actually prove any theorems about them. Okay, so what I want to study today is three-dimensional quantum gravity. And by contrast, there's a rather complete mathematical picture of what this is. And we can begin to understand what the physics of this model is. So what I want to do is, roughly speaking, talk about the observables in 3D quantum gravity. And in particular, talk about the duality that comes in. And then, after I've done that, I want to talk about the emergence of quantum mechanics. So it turns out that quantum mechanics comes in for free. And then towards the end, I want to talk about quantum field theory. And this is very much a tentative discussion here of quantum field theory in this framework. Okay, so start with a bit of mathematics. So my starting point is the Callot-Jones polynomial. So if we have a knot here and a parameter, a spin, so this is a half integer, then we can evaluate the Callot-Jones polynomial. And you should think of this spin here as labelling an irreducible representation of SU2, or here in fact the quantum group UQSL2. And we're interested particularly at in the root of unity case, so that's when the representation theory is truncated. So there's a maximum spin, which is here r minus 2 over 2. So the integer r here parameterizes the theory. And q, the quantum q, is e to the I pi over r. Okay, so you can generalize this Callot-Jones polynomial in a number of ways. In fact, you can have diagrams with open ends, and they're called tangles. So there's a functor to representation category of UQSL2. You can also generalize the Callot-Jones polynomial to graphs. And the idea is that you include an intertwining operator at the vertex. So, for example, here, this point here, this is the intertwining operator between J2 tensor J3 to J1. And so up here, you would have the intertwining operator from J6 tensor J1 tensor J5 to the trivial representation, which is represented by nothing on the diagram. So this entire diagram represents a morphism from the trivial representation to the trivial representation, is therefore a number. So this is a generalization of the Callot-Jones polynomial. And in fact, this formalism has all the symmetries, just like in knot theory, you can move things around in three-dimensional space, so you can with these vertices as well. And in fact, the general framework is you can move things around on the surface of S2. You think of this plane here as completed to S2. So this is what's known as a spherical category. Okay, and this defines the 6J symbol, and this is the traditional notation for it. It's a function of those 6 spin labels, and there's a normalizing factor lambda, which is defined like that. So, first, this is the first appearance of the duality which I spoke about. So, this is the Fourier relation, which I found for quantum 6J symbols. So, you simply square the quantum 6J symbol, and you Fourier transform each label, each spin label. So, there's a Fourier kernel, which is just a matrix in these two spin labels, I and J, and here it is very explicitly down the bottom here. So you sum over all values of J1, multiplied by this, all J2, so on, each has its own kernel. And that's a discrete Fourier transform, a sort of discrete sine transform in each variable. Now, the miraculous thing about this formula is that you get, again, the square of the 6J symbol. But it's kind of been inverted, or being dualized, in fact. So if you look carefully at these labels here, whereas you have J4, J5, J6 along the top row here, you have along the bottom row here.
Do you interpret this duality in the language of SL2 yourself?
Yeah, I'll talk about that in a minute, actually. Yeah, there is a way of talking about that. So if you actually come back to this picture here of this tetrahedron, the I labels actually are kind of written on in the dual sense. So if you write down this tetrahedron and then write its dual and then carry the labels over, you'd have the right labelling for the 6J symbol on the right hand side of this relation. So you should think here of the duality between position space and momentum space in Feynman diagrams. indeed that's the sort of thing this turns out to be. So just to anticipate a bit, you write down the Feynman diagram and you integrate in position space, then you have triangle inequalities amongst the distances between vertices in the diagram, and then in the dual picture you have momenta coming in at the vertex of the diagram and the triangle inequality at the vertex of the diagram. Okay. So this simple formula generalizes in several directions. That you can write similar formulae for Hopf algebras. Quite generally, you need a matched pair of Hopf algebras, and then you can write the relation between a bicross product, 6J symbols for the bicross product and the double cross product, something like that. So in fact, you can use this to get a new formulae for quantum 6J symbols for the Lorentz group, for example, using this duality. Anyway, I'm not going to say any more about that. The two generalizations I really want to focus on, I want to explain how you can generalize this in a topological direction, and there's a sort of more sophisticated setting here. And on the one side, on the one hand, you have a thing called the relative Terreau-Viro invariant, and on the other hand, you have an invariant which is derived from the Kullar-Jones polynomial called Yokota's invariant. And the Fourier duality relates one to the other, so I'll describe that in a few minutes. And then the physics context here is Feynman diagrams of position space and momentum space, and that's the sort of physical picture for this duality that's going on. So here we have the relative Terreau-Viro invariant. So the Terreau-Viro invariant itself dates back to about 1990, and is a state sum invariant of a free manifold. And what we're doing here is making a relative version. So we've got some graph sitting in the manifold in which we have our observables. So M is a compact free manifold. And gamma is some embedded graph in this compact free manifold. So as before, we have a spin labeling each edge of this graph, and then what this data enables us to calculate is a complex number which we call the partition function of this data. And this is a topological invariant. So if you apply a homeomorphism to the three-manifold, to another three-manifold, and it carries this graph here, gamma, to a graph on the other three-manifold, and the labels carried along, and you get the same number. So I want to explain briefly how we define this invariant. And see what sort of technology goes in. So we have a triangulation of the three manifold. So there's decomposition into tetrahedra glued together on the bases. And then a state for this, so think of statistical mechanics here. A state is an assignment of a spin to each edge in the triangulation. And we're going to sum over these states. So you have some weight factors for these configurations, and they're local. It's supposed to be local physics. So you just have a weight for each simplex of each dimension. So each vertex gets this number n, which was defined before. Each edge labeled with one spin is assigned the quantum dimension of that spin. Each triangle, the number 1. And each tetrahedron is assigned the quantum 6J symbol. So actually we regard this as 0 if the if when you tensor three of the representations at an intertwiner, there aren't any intertwiners. So if you like, this factor here is zero when J1 tensor J2 doesn't contain J3. And then you use these all as weight factors, so you do what you normally do in system mechanics, you take the product of all these weight factors, and then you sum over the spin variables. And Terev and Viro define that as a, and that's a topological invariant of the three manifold. So everybody got very excited back in 1990. We didn't know all there was to know about three manifolds in those days. And of course, mathematically speaking, there was a lot of focus on manifolds, and you could define this invariant for cobordisms and have a topological quantum field theory and so on. But actually, as far as physics goes, it's not terribly exciting, and there's not very much you can deduce about the physics of closed three manifolds. So what we need is a relative version of this model. And the version presented here is fairly simple. All we do is we take my graph gamma here to be a subset of the edges of this triangulation. And then you just fix those spin labels on that graph. So, and you sum over the remaining labels here. So in this example here, J1 and J2 are fixed. This is my graph gamma in blue here. And then I sum over J3, J4, all the rest, all the ones on the green edges. And I sum the product of all these weight factors here. And it turns out there's some work. This is independent, again, of the triangulation and gives you this topological invariant. Okay, so now I want to do some examples and sort of start to describe in physics terms what these look like. So I'll move this over here somewhere. And click on chalk. So the simplest possible example we can do is to take some free manifold and just have my my observable to be a single edge. Okay. And that comes labeled with some spin here. And then I do a calculation. Put the partition function, this graph gamma here. This is gamma. Well, of M. I can divide through by the partition function of the manifold without any graph at all. I get the following formula. Like this. And del A is this quantum dimension factor, which I wrote previously, so let's be explicit. And n is simply the sum of the squares of these things. So you see, you want to interpret this as a probability. So thinking about physics now, I want to say this is a probability that this observable should have value A. At this point, we can write rather a nice sort of physical model of what's going on. So this is kind of the physics explanation. What I'm going to do is draw a round three sphere the radius r over 2 pi. And now think of this as actually being in this geometrical sphere. So one point at one end clearly can be anywhere, it doesn't really matter, so we're just going to fix that at the North Pole. Call that point P, if you like. And the other end has got to be a certain distance away from the first one. And the way it works out is the distance is a plus a half. And then you see, if you thought naively about just placing points on the sphere, you'd say, well, what's the probability this thing would be at this distance from this thing? And the answer is its locus would be on a small sphere. And of course the area, the measure of that locus is in fact just this sine squared, just the square of this sine here. So this thing interpreted as probability is also the measure of the locus of these points. So Z probability. Of points. And that's three. So in that way the geometry of the three sphere enters. And we see very nicely, of course, when you square this thing up, it goes up and then comes back down again as you approach the maximum value that's allowed here. And so the allowed possible values for this, of course, at half integer intervals, and it gets smaller again, and the last one is kind of just before you reach the south pole. So they all fit, all the possible allowed values fit very nicely in this geometry. So let's do a slightly more sophisticated example. So I have a graph containing two edges. Now, of course, you can't quite get this from a triangulation, but in fact it generalizes to things that are almost triangulations. So there's no problem in defining this. And I have to assume that topologically speaking, this is there's a disk in there. So this is the unknot. And in the calculation, a similar calculation as above gives me the answer. The delta function. So this is, again, this is Z over, let's call this W. W is the normalized probability. So you see it's the same formula as before, except that it forces A and B to be equal. So it tells you if you make a measurement twice, of this distance between these pair of points. The first one can be anything as before, but the second one is fixed to be equal to the value of the first one. So that's nice. That's what physics should do. So here's another example. So a triangular configuration, and again I'm going to ensure that, or assume that this is an unknot, so this is contractible, there's a disk filling that in, and this time I get a formula like this, some constant, yeah I'll write it right out. again, now these quantum dimensions appear, but just once, not squared. It's that or zero, and that depends on the triangle inequalities. Here, obviously, they come in because of the representation theory. So it's zero if triangle inequality is violated. And what are these triangle inequalities? Well, they're actually, when you work them out, it's the usual ones for a metric space, but there's another one, and you can interpret them as the triangle inequalities for a spherical triangle on the sphere. So again, there's a physics picture. Where you have a spherical triangle of side a plus a half, b plus a half, and c plus a half. And this condition that this is non-zero is that there exists such a triangle on the sphere of radius r over 2 pi. And moreover, this formula here is the classical formula you'd write down for the measure of triangles with that, those fixed values of those edge lengths if you scattered the points randomly on three sphere. So if you just do a little bit of calculus and write down dA, dB, dC, that's the measure for random points on the sphere. So you see, you get kind of geometry coming out here in these very simple situations. Okay, so here's now another example, which again won't really surprise anyone. Let's see why the coins are there. If I do the whole tetrahedral graph, then I just get the quantum 6J symbol squared and some normalizing factors. And this is unsurprising because, of course, you can make the whole of the free sphere here by just gluing two balls together. So you think of each tetrahedron as a solid ball, glue two of them together. That's essentially a triangulation of the three sphere with just two tetrahedra. And so in the product of weights here, you just have those two tetrahedra. And there they are. It's just that one 6J symbol squared. And there's no sum because all of the edges in this triangulation are now in the graph gamma. Okay, so I'll come back to some more another more sophisticated example later. So now I want to turn to the dual thing. Remember, I was generalizing the Fourier relation. So here's, in this manifold setting, the dual gadget. That's going to be the target of the Fourier transform. So the definition is a little bit subtle here. You have a trivalent graph, so that's one that only has three valent vertices, or in fact none at all, so you can have knots here, that would be included. Then your Cotes invariant is just to take the mod square of the Calder-Jones polynomial. Now for general graphs, supposing you've got a four valent vertex, for example, what you do is you reduce that to your Cotes invariant for the three-valent vertex by summing out the values of this intermediate spin here. So you put in these triangle coefficients and sum them out, and that defines the four-valent vertex. And this has the property it doesn't matter which way you resolve this four-valent vertex. You see, there are three ways of doing it. You split the edges into pairs in three ways. So there are three such formulae like this, but they all give the same answer. Okay, so this gives you an invariant of a graph of any valence embedded in S3. And in fact, you can generalize this to manifolds. I mean, it doesn't have to be S3 here. You just write here the Wittenrush-Tekin-Tarrant invariant, which is the Jones polynomial for manifolds. So, having done that, we can write the Fourier transform now. Let's see, some of it off the picture. In this more general setting, you take the relative Tourette-Virou invariant, you Fourier transform the same way, and you get the Cotter invariant. And this should be divided by Z of M. Actually, it's in fact, it's been missed off. Again, the Fourier kernel, again, is slightly adjusted by normalization. I've taken the kernel I had before and divided through by quantum dimension coefficients. Just to keep the normalization straight. So, for example, your Cotter's invariant for the tetrahedral graph is also the 6J symbol squared. Okay, because it's Carlos-Jones polynomial. And then you see this Fourier theorem here applied to this very special case of the tetrahedron in S3 gives me this square on this side. And well, the previous transparency, the square of the 6J symbol the other side. And that was my original result. Now it's got lost now. Back in the middle. Oh, here we are. Another example. So we see here this general topological version of the duality. Okay. So that's kind of the mathematical framework. Now I want to come to the physical interpretation. Now let's leave that. This one. So this is how you should interpret what's going on. As I said before, the relative Tourette-Virou invariant, which I'm writing with these straight lines here, you should think of as specifying a distance in the quantum gravity manifold, which is given by j plus a half. In fact, I've doubled it here and multiplied by the Planck length. So it's some distance in Planck units. And the Cotter invariant, the other side of the Fourier duality, which I've written with a wiggly line, you should think of physically in terms of the metrics, which are in this manifold. They're all metrics with a certain cone angle here. So this parameter k here and the Carlos-Jones polynomial, if I take k over r and multiply by 4 pi, that gives me a parameter that runs between 0 and 2 pi. So what you should think of is metrics which have this cone geometry outside of the line where this particle's running. So if you have a particle running along a line like this and you take a transverse section through it, then you have a two-dimensional cone geometry. So in that situation, you'd call the cone angle, roughly speaking, the mass. And so this parameter here on the Cotter's invariant is the mass that's running along through there. So what you should think of is that there's a functional integral going on in the background, working out these partition functions. And in the one case here, you're integrating over all metrics which give that certain distance specified and that observable. And in this case here, you're thinking of doing a functional integral over all metrics which have a given conical defect around the line where the observable is. And because there's a Fourier relation between the two, these things are complementary. It's just like the usual uncertainty principle. If you measure one, you can't measure the other, and vice versa. So in fact, if you specify the distance along a curve there, then the angle around, you get the conical defect angle around it, if you measure that, that's sort of maximally uncertain. and vice versa. If you measure fixed down the conical defector angle around some curve, then the length of it becomes maximally uncertain. Okay. So I want to describe now my more sophisticated example, which has all of these new features in it. So this is an example of a gravitational interaction. You see, the examples I did on the board here are all kind of static, kinematical things. In fact, that's because they're all planar. See, if they're planar, you can take your manifold, well, the manifold that you start with could be S3, and you can put them all in a two-sphere in the middle there, and it's really just the inner product in some Hilbert space, so it's all just happening at one instant of time. So to get something where there's something dynamical going on, you need some diagram that isn't planar. So I've got here one of the simplest non-planar things, that's the hot link. And so I put three vertices in it here, so there's one vertex here, and there's a wiggly particle of mass m going around and joining back to where it started. And there's two vertices here, so we're measuring this distance along A here and this distance along B here through a different route, which intertwines the particle, Alan.
I'm a little bit confused. You are working in Euclidean, or what is the setup?
This is quantum gravity.
Yes. Yeah, but is it Euclidean, or is it...
Yes. So you should be thinking of Euclidean metrics here.
Okay.
So that's why we have the S3 geometry coming here, and not the SIF space or something.
You mean you are thinking about the path integral in Euclidean?
Yes. But you have to be careful here. It's with e to the I times the action.
Even though you are in Euclidean?
Yes.
That's a little bit weird,
isn't
to say
it?
The least.
You know? Yeah. So I don't subscribe to this view that the functional integral with oscillatory term is badly behaved. In fact, I don't think that's correct. If you do this functional integral exactly, it's very well behaved.
I mean, with the I?
Yes, with the I.
What is it that allows you to justify the I? I mean, if you work Euclidean, how can you justify...
Well, no. So if you... If you think of 3 plus 1 physics, you have a signature, let's say it's minus plus plus plus.
2 plus 1.
So if you have 3 plus 1, you can have minus plus plus plus. And now I want to go down to 3 dimensions, so I want to delete something. So I could delete a plus and go to minus plus plus with e to the I action, or I could delete the minus and go to plus 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 with e to the I action. And that's what we're doing. So there's no rotation into...
It's not Euclidean. It's not Euclidean. It is a spatial part of the form.
Could be, yes.
So you don't consider the Chern-Simons with S2?
I'll come to that.
Or are you consider Chern-Simons with S2?
With S2, yes. Okay, so here's a gravitational interaction. So I've got a particle with a mass m going around here. Well, this is the physics description, so I'm calculating the partition function, the Terev-Viro, and I've Fourier transformed on this variable here for this particle going around there, but I haven't Fourier transformed on these solid lines here for A and B. And you can do a calculation involving Jones polynomial type stuff, spin networks, and here's a formula for the partition function. So the normalization constants are fairly trivial, and the business here is this I, and I is the dimension of the space of invariant tensors in A tensor M tensor B tensor M in the quantum group. And you can just simply understand that, again, by S3 geometry. You draw the quadrilaterals in S3 with side lengths, M here, M there, B and A there, and then you count the number of integer diagonals you can have here, and it's that number is the dimension of the space of invariants. Okay, so that's the mathematical calculation. Now what's the physics explanation? So there's the geometrical explanation or the semi-classical explanation. So I draw a round S3 as before, same radius. And the particle of mass m going around, you think of as going around the diameter here, and you cut out part of a cone around that diameter, so there's a conical singularity with the relevant strength there, and that 2 should be a 4. So you can do that on a free sphere, just taking a rotation and cutting out part of the way the rotation acts. So then you see that if I have 2 points there and these 2 geodesic segments here measure their lengths, then you can indeed get different answers. And so, more specifically, what you can do is, in S3 geometry, there's an SO4 connection. This is all the affine connection. And so there's a holonomy with 2 elements, lambda and rho, both in SU2. I should write that. So this is the describing the holonomy for going around this whole loop here in blue. And because the rotation has a fixed point, that fixed point is where the cone is there. It's a simple rotation, has axis. So the conjugacy classes of these 2 elements, lambda and rho and SU2, are equal. And they're both equal to this m here, which is the mass of the particle. So now you can measure the distance here along this geodesic by, you look at the holonomy in SO4, and I calculate the conjugacy class of lambda rho inverse, and that will tell me the distance along that path. So there's a simple little calculation here that the lambda 1 rho 1 is the holonomy along first path here along A with the arrow, and that's equal to the loop holonomy times the holonomy for the second path along label B there. So you multiply these holonomies together, and then you see that the distance along A here is the conjugacy class of lambda 1 rho 1 inverse, and then using this relation here, that's the conjugacy class of this product here. And you see again that you have to product these elements here, which live in the conjugacy class M, B and M in SU2, and again you get this quadrilateral in the three sphere. So these holonomies all match up if you have this figure here, the same figure here in S3. So from the semi-classical point of view, if you're doing a functional integral, you'd say, oh well, what I'm doing is measuring the volume of all the configurations that match this data in the observables, and that's the volume of configurations of this quadrilateral in S3, and that's by semi-classical quantization, or in fact actual quantization, if you do geometric quantization, that would be the dimension of this space and invariance in the quantization. So you see, you arrive at the same conclusion by looking at both the combinatorial calculation and quantum groups, and knowing nothing about physics here, and on the other hand by doing a physical calculation. So of course if m is 0, you reduce to one of these calculations I had before, just here. But of course these 2 lengths have to be the same. But if there's mass going through this here, then they can be different, and the amount of difference that's allowed depends on the mass that goes through. So, you know, it does look like gravitational physics. Okay, so we can talk about the Chern-Simons functional integral. And to paraphrase Witten, who talked about Lorentz signature, this partition function is the partition function for 3 plus 0 quantum gravity and the cosmological constant is what it has to be. So there's three spheres, the right.
But John, why is Jan Simons gravity? I mean?
Oh, okay. On the next transparency, if you write gravity in first order form, then you do a functional integral over frame fields and connection one forms.
Yeah, but that's where you have reduced the 3, 3, 1 to 3 with keeping the I.
Yeah, keeping the I, yes, that's right.
Sure.
Exactly.
And this is not gravity in 2, 1. It's gravity in
3 plus
0. 3, 1.
As I said up there, 3 plus 0 quantum gravity. Yeah. So the time has been deleted.
Okay, fine.
Yeah. Gravity has SU2 gauge symmetry, but this action is actually SU2 cross SU2 Chern-Simons. And if the cosmological constant vanishes, it's one loop exact. But anyway, it means that we know how to calculate with Chern-Simons.
Is that Albert Schwarz rather than Witten? It was Albert, for example, who was this long time before.
With lambda equals naught, yes. Is that right?
Which is the interesting case.
No, I'm interested in lambda, not naught. And then you can describe the observables. And so, in this theory, we do exactly have these holonomies, so you can simply write a delta function that says that the relevant holonomy takes the value j plus a half. So, of course, here the metrics are fluctuating. And what does this holonomy tell you? Well, you see, if you have the round sphere, this holonomy is just the distance between the pair of points. But for an arbitrary metric, it's not quite the distance. It's the distance if you have a geodesic segment. If you have something that's not a geodesic, what you have to do is draw that same non-geodesic on the round three sphere and then measure the distance between those points on the round three sphere. So it's distance in that sense. Sort of a gauge theory distance rather than metric distance, perhaps. Okay, and then this explains again. Explains how it's measured. Now, if you apply the Fourier formula, which I had to this distance observable, you get the dual observable.
What about the gauge invariance of observables and their diffeomorphism?
Diffeomorphism?
Yes. Gravity should be diffeomorphism invariant.
Yeah, diffeomorphisms are fine. This whole thing is Chern-Simons is diffeomorphism invariant, so that's fine.
Yeah, but you mean the observable is measuring a quantity which is diffeomorphism invariant?
Yeah.
What is the quantity?
Well, you measure this holonomy between these points here and then...
but the point is not a diffeomorphism invariant notion.
Yeah, okay, but you get the same answer wherever these two points are on the manifold.
Oh, okay. That's a good answer.
That's the only possible answer. Yeah. So here's the dual observable.
This doesn't depend on the manifold.
Well, it depends. In this case, it depends only very weakly on the manifold, yes. It's just an overall constant. But of course, that's because it doesn't see the topology of the manifold. But of course, if you had something extended that went around a hole in the manifold or something, you'd see the topology of the manifold. So if you apply my Fourier formula, I get the dual observable just by doing the calculus. In fact, something very simple. No, in fact, it's just a delta function. And what this turns into is the trace in the K representation of lambda rho inverse. And it's not hard to convince yourself that this... Well, if you believe Witten, that the Chern-Simons computes the Kullar-Jones polynomial, then this just turns into your Cotes invariant, which I had before. And there's some fun to be had with working out this mismatch between gauge invariance, whether it's SU2 or SU2 cross SU2. But I won't go into that. Okay, so there's a perfectly ordinary functional integral interpretation of everything, as well as the combinatorial stuff. But of course,
explain duality in this setting. You promised to explain duality in this setting.
Oh yeah, sorry, it's very trivial. It's just that if I take this formula here with a delta function and multiply by the Fourier kernel, I get that formula over there. It's just because the trace in the K representation is just this formula. Well, it just involves signs. It's just, you know, so it's just the formula for the Fourier kernel. Now let's. In fact, here it is. Oops, disappeared. So here's the Fourier kernel, which is also the character formula over there on that transparency. And here's the fun thing. This formula is kind of non-local. So this is where we start to think about the physics. So, of course, you see, from the point of view of this J position space, when I transform to momentum space, of course that's kind of non-local. But we can really see that in the following way. But if you think of this Fourier kernel here, so think of K as a parameter and J varying now, and instead of J, I want to take J plus a half, because that's the physical distance. And I actually want to think of that, call that R, think of that as a coordinate on the three sphere down in this picture here. So fix the North Pole, and it's the distance from the North Pole. So it's one of the usual coordinates on S3. Now this function here, this Fourier kernel, satisfies this wave equation here, or the Helmholtz equation. So in fact it's a harmonic with this eigenvalue on S3. So in fact this is the fundamental solution for this wave operator. So it's spherically symmetric by rotations about the North Pole, and it obeys the equation like this. So you have this picture where, although I said there was a picture where you have these precise cones for the metric characterizing the geometry, in this alternative picture here, if you start with the position space representation, so the length of this curve, and then do this Fourier thing, you have actually some sort of wave on S3 going on. So the conclusion is that actually quantum mechanics comes in for free. These observables aren't just sort of fixed, painted on particles on this background manifold. They are actually already quantized particles. So that brings me to sort of particle quantization principle, which I think was first mentioned very briefly in a footnote in one of Witten's papers. I don't know if it goes back even more. The idea is that if you have a, think of having in quantum mechanics, gravity, having a fixed trajectory for a particle and a fluctuating metric. Well, think of a flat metric, so a particle in Minkowski space or something with a fixed trajectory, but now allow the flat metric to fluctuate amongst all flat metrics. That's equivalent, it's the same thing as saying by diffeomorphisms we'll bring the trajectory back to where it started. We'll bring the metrics back to the flat Minkowski metric you started with, but now the trajectory fluctuates. And now in quantum mechanics, you're supposed to think of quantum mechanics, the propagation from A to B, as fluctuating trajectories. So we see here this principle that quantizing the metric is sort of equivalent to the particle trajectory being quantized.
Just a change of variables in the functionality column.
I'm sorry, what?
You are starting with the functionality column and you just change variables there.
Yes, exactly. So it's just like the Higgs fluctuations disappearing into the...
One could argue that if you are given the functional integral, you are given quantum mechanics from the start.
Yes, but I haven't... The whole point is I haven't quantized the particle. All I've quantized is gravity.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure, but by changing variables, you are in effect quantizing the particle.
Yes, that's the principle. So it's just like in gauge theories where the Higgs fluctuations can be thought of as gauge boson fluctuations, vice versa. And the point that you can, this complementarity, you can only measure half the variables at any one time.
John, I'm confused about this word particle now, because you said we're talking about spatial gravity. So these are not world lines, which are kind of line-like defects.
Yeah. So it's unphysical from that point of view. If you think of this as a slice of four dimensions, these just particles are tachyonic. So this is sort of tachyonic particles. So this is unphysical. Yes, of course. But in three dimensions is unphysical. So I'm allowed to, I'm allowed some license and to choose in which way it's unphysical, and this is the way we do it. So that brings us on to the proposal for coupling Feynman diagrams to gravity. So here's a rough sketch of
same objection. Same objection takes place. What are Feynman diagrams if you don't have time?
Okay, so this is Feynman diagrams in this space. So if you like, there's these tachyonic particles in a Feynman diagram. So if we do a calculation of this Feynman diagram amplitude in position space, we would have the positions of the vertices here, xi and xj. And then the propagator here, gf, would depend on the distance here, in fact the modulus xi minus xj here. And then we integrate over all the positions in space. Now, of course, you can rewrite this integral because it actually only depends on these distances here. You could rewrite this as an integral over these distances and not over the vectorial x's. So that's done in the next line here, that there's some humongous Jacobian change of variables going on here to go from the x's to these distances, rij. So this thing here will involve lots of sine and cosines and awful stuff that actually you have to calculate when you do particle physics calculations. And of course the propagator is just a function of these distances, so that's fine. And now here's the proposal. The proposal is that you replace the whole of the kinematic part here, this whole function mu here, with a partition function that comes out of quantum gravity.
Will you replace the Jacobian by this?
Yes. So this Jacobian here, together with the dr factors, becomes the partition function in quantum gravity with these distances along labelling that Feynman graph.
I mean, you are changing the functional measure, essentially.
Yeah, so we're changing the measure in the Feynman integral. Instead of being a continuum measure here with these usual factors, we're now using a discrete measure here, which is given by the quantum gravity partition function.
What is the rationale for that? Why do you do that?
It's just a proposal. So the idea is we want to couple Feynman diagrams to quantum gravity and see what happens.
But the best way would be to write a full functional integral where you would include terms generating the Feynman diagrams. I mean, this would be much simpler.
Maybe. But
then you have no freedom to play around.
Yeah, so that's what we want to do. But yeah, we're just doing this for now. So the spin variables become discrete here, and this integral becomes a summation with a finite range of values. And everything here in the usual formalism actually becomes finite. Now there's no divergence of any diagram whatsoever. So if you like, the proposal is that quantum gravity replaces the kinematic part of the Feynman diagram definition. So here's the formula. Then, when you've done that replacement, you need some sort of discrete propagator here, instead of the continuum one, and you want that to reduce to the continuum one in a suitable limit. And the limit is when you take the parameter r to infinity. That's the limit in which the Planck length goes to zero. And then, of course, all the old divergences will appear in the limit. So this is a regularization procedure. And, of course, you can take that limit so that in the limit the masses are constant. So the momenta on the Feynman diagram converge to the usual sorts of momenta. So here's an example. Very simple example. If you have a tree, you do this, then the relevant quantum gravity partition function here is just a constant times these product of sine squared factors. So in fact, it's just like this example up here, which I started with, this factor here, except that you now have a framework, think of lots of rods, and you're measuring the quantum gravity thing will measure the measure of these rods flopping around in three-dimensional space. And of course, that's just the kinematic part of the Feynman diagram. It's exactly what you want. So for tree diagrams, it's obvious that you get the same measure. The only thing is it's discrete instead of continuum. Yeah. Okay, and then in the limit, this will converge to the product of sine factors with ordinary distances, and that's just that Jacobian mu, which you need. Now you can do this.
Topological invariant this way.
I'm sorry.
Do you get a topological invariant this way? So really,
Not any new one. Not any more so than we had already.
It's still topological invariant.
But maybe if you knew. Okay. So what we don't know is what the Feynman rules are. So if you could sum over all Feynman diagrams, then maybe you'd have a topological invariant.
There's the question. There is, if you have diffeomorphism invariance in your picture, so that's if you violate the diffeomorphism.
Yes, you have diffeomorphism invariance. Huh? Yes. Yes, you have diffeomorphism invariance. Yeah. Yes. Okay, so you can do this whole picture in momentum space, and again, you simply take some discrete propagator. This is the usual momentum Feynman diagrams of the delta function, and the propagator in momentum space, and then I simply rewrite that in terms of the modulus of all the momenta, and then I can replace with the Yokota invariant, just as I did in the dual picture earlier. And providing, of course, your propagator in momentum space is correctly chosen, this gives you exactly the same formalism. And the duality between position and momentum space works out exactly right, as it should do in quantum field theory. So a couple of very simple examples, which I should explain here. Well, now, actually let me write it up. Supposing you want to calculate now the propagation of amplitude of a particle. You want to calculate the two-point function. So you want some particle to go along line from A to B, from P to Q, and you want to calculate what we would normally think of as a two-point function. Well, that doesn't make any sense, unless, of course, you specify how far apart these two points are. So you need to include in your picture another line, which is sort of, a fix. This is some macroscopic object, if you like, which fixes that distance. So you calculate here, this is the particle propagating. I don't quite have a notation for this, except that there's nothing written on the line. So you've summed over with your propagator, and this is the observable in the old previous sense with a fixed distance A. And then you do a calculation of the Feynman diagram amplitude in that situation, and you do indeed just get the propagator as the two-point function. And indeed times the measure, kinematical measure, for its phase space. And in a similar way, you could discuss a three-point function. If I want to calculate a particle three-point function, again, I need to know as a function of what, this is quantum gravity, so I need to put in macroscopic objects which define if you like a framework, a triangle of sides A, B, and C, and then I can have a particle shooting around in here, and then you have a three-point function as a function of A, B, and C. So it's possible to do the usual things that one wants to do, but with just a slight adjustment to the formalism. Now here's where the fun starts. If you have loop diagrams and they're knotted, it's different. And this is something that's completely different to the usual quantum field theory. So it seems that the formalism of non-commutative quantum field theory or braided quantum field theory or both at once is not sufficient to describe this kind of phenomenon. But one doesn't have knots in three-dimensional space coming out. So there's something genuinely new and different here. And what we don't really understand is what Feynman rules are that will generate these diagrams in a systematic fashion. Let me just finish by giving some observations about this example here with the knot. you see, essentially what's going on here is that what's the difference between these two diagrams is essentially controlled by the knot invariant. You see, what you have to worry about is the momentum that's running around the knot. And the external legs here go off to some other part of the diagram.
John, why are the lines not allowed to cross? I mean, why cannot, can't I do a move that makes the two lines cross?
Sure, I can cross, like here.
So, I mean, why can't I just go across one line?
With a vertex?
Or with another line?
Yeah, you can, sure, of course you can.
So why is the knot invariant?
Why is the knot?
I mean, I can undo a knot.
Oh, why you can't go from there to there? Why one can't pass through the other one?
Yeah.
Oh, because it's gravity. And then, you see, in the functional integral, think that way, if you have two lines like that, there's some gravitational field configurations going on, and then the other way around, they're different. And you can see very precisely in this example here that the gravitational fields that respond to the momentum of the particle going around the loop, they respond in a different way. And we're integrating over all those. So in fact, what you should look at is if you put the momentum of all these lines here to zero, then really you just have to worry about the momentum that's going around in the loop here.
Yeah, but what I mean is that I would agree that this is fine for the gravity part, but why should it be important for the Feynman graphs?
Well, they're coupled.
Coupled, but...
So you see, what goes on here...
I mean, this is contrary to what you have with ordinary graphs, so you never get the usual answer for ordinary graphs. I mean, if you prevent them from crossing, you will not get the same answer as for ordinary graphs.
Yeah, that's right. So you've partitioned the usual graphs up into different classes.
Into different classes.
Yes, that's right. That's what we have to understand. And if they cross, they interact. Well, if they actually intersect, they interact. So... you can understand what's going on by taking the limit where R goes to infinity, where you get back to the usual quantum field theory. And if you take the trefoil knot and do a calculation, then you see that this invariant here, this knot invariant here, essentially scales differently depending on the mass. So I have a particle of a certain mass running around this loop here. And when it's below a certain value, which for the trefoil knot is pi by 3 in Planck units, well, in Planck units divided by 4 pi, then of the Planck mass, then it scales in a certain way. So it's really there's two that's important here. It scales like R squared. So R is the cutoff, if you like, in the usual sense. It's the cutoff in the Feynman diagram calculation. And when the mass gets past a certain stage, past this critical angle here, it scales differently. In fact, there's another power of the cutoff coming in. And you can actually understand what's going on, that when you get past the critical angle, pi by 3, then there exist non-abelian homomorphisms from pi 1 into SU2. And what that means is that around this knot, there are now a bigger class of gravitational configurations than there were for small angles. So actually what happens is that if you do a semi-classical approximation, this knot here, all the gravitational configurations tell you that essentially this thing running around here has size 0. But what happens when you get past this critical angle is you can have these non-abelian gravitational configurations, and they can suddenly have macroscopic size. And there's one more parameter coming in for the size of these, and that's the additional parameter in this Feynman diagram business. So there's some unexpected things there, and some projects to work on. So I've more or less come to the end of what I've got to say, and I'll ask for any questions.